Support for the Capital Connection comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. Joining us this week is Brian Fessler, Chief Advocacy Officer for the New York State School Boards Association. That's NISBA, and they provide advocacy training and information to school boards in support of their mission to govern the state's public schools. They have so much more that they do, and you can learn about at their website. That's NISBA.org, NYSSBA.org. We welcome Brian Fessler to the Capital Connection. So glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much, David. Good to be with you.
Well, let's just start, Brian, with a simple, very simple question. Currently, what are the major issues impacting the school boards?
I think school boards throughout the state, you know, we deal with a wide range of issues, kind of traditional educational and instructional issues. But school board members are elected officials. They help govern and lead, you know, large institutions. And so our members are regularly focused on funding issues, budget issues, and that's on the school aid side via the state budget, but then also via local funding, generally property taxes. And so this time of year, during the state budget conversations, which are a key part of local school district budget development, that's where, you know, I'd say on average, most school board members' focus right now is on the funding side of the education system.
Well, if you've been following the education system for a while, and I know you have, and certainly we have here, the idea of foundation aid and the foundation aid formula is something that just continues on the treadmill each and every year. You know, there was a lawsuit years ago to try to get the schools funded adequately, and that lawsuit was won. And yet, since then, there is still this push to make sure that the foundation aid formula is updated. And I know the school boards earlier at the beginning of the year said that's one of the areas that the budget does not address, this, quote, woefully outdated formula.
Yeah, the foundation aid formula, especially this time of year, but, you know, really throughout the year, you see a lot of focus on it, I think, for two reasons. One, there is a very practical short-term relevance. Foundation aid drives system-wide and for the overwhelming majority of most individual districts. Foundation aid serves as the main vehicle of state financial support for school districts. And so on an annual basis, as school districts are developing and then implementing and executing their local budgets, the funding provided through the foundation aid formula, which is the state's main kind of operating aid and operating financial support for school districts, that foundation aid formula and the amount driven through that formula for each district, it serves as the lifeblood of resources for schools to educate students, pay for staff, run normal operations in a district. So, you know, every annual cycle, we have this real focused short-term interest in where foundation aid is going. But there's also a long-term conversation. You know, you referenced the fact that the foundation aid formula essentially grew out of some cases now multiple decades old around school aid and appropriate funding levels.
Yeah, the, was called what, the Campaign for Fiscal Equity back then?
Correct. And that began in the 90s, ran into the early 2000s, and ultimately kind of culminated, or the endpoint, dealt with the creation of the foundation aid formula originally under Governor Spitzer's time in office. You know, but that was created in 2007. We're now two decades beyond that. And we have changing educational expectations, education environment, technology, expectations, goals, et cetera. And so over the long term, we always want to make sure we have a school funding system that meets the needs of students of today and tomorrow, and not the needs of students of yesterday and two decades ago. So Foundation Aid is always a topic of discussion. Again, short term, long term, we need the funding each year, in a very practical way. But we also want to make sure that our funding structure and our funding system is working in a way that meets, and continually meets the needs of our students of this generation and next generation.
We're speaking with Brian Fessler, Chief Advocacy Officer for the New York State School Boards Association. Brian, it always bothered me. Again, my opinion here, that they fund the schools out of the property taxes. You know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that if you're in a poorer area where the housing tax base is lower, you don't get as much in funding. They try to make up for that. But we often see the same poorer results in those areas with a poorer tax base. They often are schools that don't have after-school programs or other things that many of the wealthier school districts do. So at the very base of funding schools in New York State, to me, it's flawed that you're taking the money out of the property taxes. And then when you have older folks who may not have kids in school or may have not ever had children, they complain, why am I funding the public schools? So, this kind of thing to me is part of the real kink in the hose, if you will, of funding.
Yeah, I think that's a fair observation. And that's something that, again, system-wide and at an individual district level, is incredibly relevant in these conversations. Statewide, and this is, very roughly on average, we see about a little north of 50% or about 55% or so of the state's education funding structure supported by local revenue, which for the overwhelming majority of districts is via the property tax. About 40% or so is funded by state aid, and then about 5% or so, single digits, supported by federal dollars. So that's the overall statewide system. But on an individual district basis, you have some wealthier districts in some areas of the state that are funded almost entirely by property taxes and local resources. Conversely, on the other side of the coin, you have some of the needier districts that may have extremely limited local tax base and local wealth, and their funding structure is almost exclusively or heavily dependent on state aid and state dollars. And so kind of trying to navigate these statewide conversations and what the state budget is doing and how the tax cap works, these are all important conversations and discussions. But for individual districts, a wealthy district may not really care too much where state aid is going because it has very little impact or significance on the state budget. But needier districts, less wealthy districts, the impact of the property tax cap is very muted. But where state budget conversations go and where foundation aid goes and other aid formulas for schools, that is incredibly important. So trying to navigate all these in a way that appropriately, adequately, and equitably supports students from every zip code in every district in every area of the state is a constant effort. And it is always a work in progress to move the needle in that direction.
Absolutely. I think people don't realize how complicated and nuanced many of the issues are from school district to school district. Again, we're speaking with Brian Fessler, Chief Advocacy Officer for the New York State School Boards Association, NISBA. Brian, I've seen lately this effort to merge school districts as well. As population drops and you have fewer students, especially in some of these rural areas, we're seeing this. The school boards have to be involved in that, right?
Yeah, that's something that, I think is maybe somewhat surprising to many of your listeners. That is a frequent conversation that goes on at a variety of different layers and levels among school districts throughout the state. The process of mergers or consolidations among school districts requires a lot of steps, multiple votes, multiple studies. Anywhere amongst that kind of structure or time frame, school districts and school leaders and school board members, superintendents, maybe having kind of very basic conversations all the way to, you know, formal votes like we recently saw in the Capital Region for it, you know, an ultimate merger vote of districts. You know, historically, there are two main challenges to districts that are looking into mergers. One is tax base imbalances. And so, you know, depending on what the tax structure looks like, if two districts merge, one district's residents may see taxes go down or suppress a little bit, where conversely, in order to balance, the districts that may be on the low end would see, you know, their taxes increase in order to get to that middle point. So that's one challenge. I think the other part is, you know, the local culture and identity of individual school districts, especially at the elementary school level. You know, sometimes we see either formally or informally communities not support a merger because they don't want to lose that local identity. And so, you know, there are constant conversations around there. One important change from a year or two ago, the state meaningfully increased an incentive aid to support school district mergers. And so I think that's why, you know, perhaps, and this is somewhat anecdotal, but, you know, we've begun to see a decent amount more focused conversations and studies and discussions around potential mergers, because there's a lot more dollars now to support that merger process. And that's important because, you know, you may need facility investments in order to build a new central high school that's more appropriate geographically. And in order to kind of level up and balance out, you know, staffing levels and kind of all of those operational components within, you know, two or multiple districts that merge, some of those near-term dollars to support and incentivize that process are important. And so, you know, we've already begun to see some more conversations amongst districts. I expect that to continue, but it's not easy. You know, you have some really, really small rural districts, especially in the North Country, that, you know, at a quick pass may look like it makes sense for them to think about merging, but their geographic footprint may be enormous. And so, you know, you merge districts, but now you have students on buses for an hour, hour and a half each way, where practically speaking, there, you know, remain some operational barriers to mergers. But we've already seen growing conversations. I expect that to continue. And really, that's due to some recent financial incentives and adjustments that the state enacted within the state budget process a year or two ago.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me, this issue of identity. It's hard for the school districts to let go. And we've seen that even when we are looking at villages and towns and cities. We have so many different municipalities labels that even trying to combine some of those resources is tough. Well, let's move toward this issue of universal pre-K. Where are the school boards here?
Yeah, we, for a number of years, have been very supportive of continued investments and efficiencies in a more universal pre-kindergarten offering for school districts across the state. The state, over the past few decades, has provided funding for pre-K. A lot of districts have some level of pre-K, not all. But what we've seen over the past 20, 30 years is each time there's a new kind of significant state investment in pre-K offering, it usually ends up being through a new or unique funding stream or program that is similar to the previous program, but might have slightly different funding levels, slightly different programmatic requirements, reporting structures. And so, you know, we have these multiple different tentacles out there supporting pre-K in a way that is somewhat challenging, you know, to navigate and operate for individual districts. And the financial question that school districts have been challenged with is the state funding levels simply for the overwhelming majority of districts are not enough to meaningfully support pre-K. And that's not just, you know, the instructional cost. There's some space and facility concerns. There continues to be staffing challenges. There's questions around transportation, availability of providers. A number of districts use community-based organizations to provide their pre-K programs. And sometimes, you know, there may simply not be a provider available to execute those services. So there's dollars out there, and there have been dollars out there. But believe it or not, they frequently are not fully tapped into those resources because of a lack of provider or barriers in this area or another. So we are very pleased to see the governor propose a relatively meaningful and significant expansion of pre-K availability, leveling up to a relatively significant degree the amount of per pupil funding going to districts to support pre-K programs. I think that will make a meaningful difference. You know, the string or the catch is that the governor's proposal within 3 years would mandate that all school districts provide pre-K opportunities to any student whose parents or guardian requests those services. So right now it's effectively voluntary. There's some resources, but districts are basically left to do what they are interested or able to do. So, you know, this is a significant investment, but there are some, you know, mandates at the end of this transition. And so most of our conversations with the governor's office and legislators and staff members over the past couple months have been focused on some of those non-financial barriers to support school district implementation around staffing ratios, around transportation requirements and supports, facilities and space supports. So some of those kind of operational pieces to make sure that this can be a successful transition for school districts. But at a high level, an overall goal standpoint, we are incredibly supportive of continued supports and investments in early childhood education and, you know, getting our students into our school systems earlier to, you know, help make sure that the transition into kindergarten, elementary school and beyond is as efficient and successful as it can be.
So when it comes to universal pre-K across the state, are you saying this is an unfunded, partially funded, or mostly funded mandate by the end of it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think ultimately it depends on the district. You know, I'm sure some districts will view this as a mostly funded eventual mandate, and some, you know, perhaps are a little bit more concerned. I think, you know, the districts that, and there are a handful of dozen across the state that have no pre-K offerings. So I think those districts and the districts that may have a very minimal level of pre-K offerings, those are the districts that are going to find this plan a little bit more challenging, especially in the near term. But, you know, to be clear, the state's pre-K investments, they are not intended at all to fully cover the cost of pre-K. So for all districts at varying levels, there will be, in one way or another, some local share of costs that, you know, as we discussed earlier in this conversation, ultimately is supported by local taxpayers. So that part is clear, but depending on, you know, the availability of providers, the history of pre-K in some districts, you know, the cost balance may be a little bit different district to district, and, you know, the challenge or the difficulty in implementing what is much closer to a universal pre-kindergarten program will be more challenging for some districts than others.
Well, speaking of challenges, and some might not think about this when it comes to the schools, but the climate mandates from the CLCPA, which is Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, that the governor has said, hey, wait a minute, we're not going to be able to implement this law and make these goals. We have to push them back and adjust. Otherwise, we'll be breaking the law here. Many have jumped on that, including her rivals in the Republican Party, saying, yes, this is certainly not affordable. And when we look at the, forgive the not meant to be a pun, perfect storm of not only the climate changing, but then with utility costs not going down, but going up because of the war in Iran, the federal government's denial of climate change on so many levels, you would also have to look at the schools and the utility costs associated with their budgets and what you're going to do. So I know you're worried about zero emissions school bus requirements.
Yeah, I think this issue over the past 2-3+ years is probably what we have consistently heard about the most from school board members. And so you mentioned CLCPA, which was adopted by the state, I think, in 2019. And then a few years later, post-pandemic, this zero-emission school bus mandate was adopted in 2022. And that mandate says that by 2027, So in about 14, 15 months or so, that any new school bus purchase in New York State has to be zero emission. And by 2035, no traditional or combustible engine buses, school buses, can be on the road after that date. And so CLCPA, which interestingly, this zero emission school bus mandate is not at all formally or technically part of CLCPA, even though the overall kind of, you know, goals and intent, and frankly, a lot of the same challenges and barriers are consistent with CLCPA. You know, CLCPA adopted in 2019, and I think first set, and I don't profess to be an expert in CLCPA, but I believe some of the emissions goals that first pass was, is, at least as of now, 2030 for some of the emission reduction goal deadlines. So adopted in 2019, a goal set for 2030, where for zero emission buses, adopted in 2022 with the first goal of 2027. So a much more condensed timeframe. On the early end, there were a ton of questions. This is, you know, a brand new, big, significant requirement for school districts. There are a ton of questions because transportation is, you know, inherent in education in schools. I think to the average person, what do you think about schools? You think of maybe a, you know, American flag in front of a school building and yellow buses transporting students to schools. And so a lot of questions, and pretty quickly, school leaders realized that this is an incredibly costly transition. Just the buses by themselves, right now, a zero-emission bus is about three times or nearly three times as much as a traditional diesel bus, about $450,000 or so compared to about $150,000. So that right now, right there, a significant cost. Infrastructure costs, other ancillary costs. And on the power side, we unfortunately continue to hear from a lot of districts that have engaged with their utility provider. And those utilities have either said, no, we are simply in the near term not able to provide your district with the amount of power and electricity necessary to transition your fleet. That's a challenge in some of those areas. There's a potential to upgrade some of those utilities, but then that has an added cost. Availability and reliability of the batteries on some of these buses. It's just, you know, every week we transition and we have new questions and concerns pop up, when at this point in the mandate and the transition, we are hoping to have a lot of those questions answered. And a lot of the technological advances that would have allowed us to get to a better point in this process, but we're simply not there. Federal complications. So we've been sharing with lawmakers, you know, our support for either a full repeal of this based on the current structure, or a significant delay or change in the time frame, because under the current requirement, there are simply too many districts that are not able to meet the requirements of this law, simply not able to do so. And the districts that are able to do so are looking at exorbitant cost numbers that will ultimately, you know, impact other school district operations and programs and services available to students. And, you know, I think that's a decision and a trade-off that school board members and a lot of school leaders are not excited about and are not looking forward to right now.
We're speaking with Brian Fessler, Chief Advocacy Officer for the New York State School Boards Association. You could read more at NYSSBA.org. That's NYSSBA.org. We're running out of time. Brian, I want to ask you one final question. And that's the lack of support from the federal government. And when I look at, for example, what your core beliefs are in NYSBA, I start to shudder when I get to diversity, equity, and inclusion, something that the federal government does not like at all.
Yeah, you know, most of our work in support of our members over the past, well, year and a half in particular, but always, you know, we are working to make sure our members have all the information and supports necessary to be effective governance leaders of their school districts. And so, you know, with a lot of the challenges at the federal level, I think that work has focused on two lanes. One is funding. I mentioned early on that system-wide, less than 10% of education dollars in the state comes via the federal government. But for some districts, especially higher need districts, that percentage is higher. And so as there have been threats or proposals to cut or freeze or redistribute or fill in the descriptor, federal dollars, we have worked and advocated with the state's congressional delegation, with our partners in D.C. to make sure that all school districts in the state have the educational resources and financial resources necessary and that they should have to support, you know, their students' education. So that has been part of our advocacy. That's always true, but, you know, obviously there's been a lot more conversations and challenges on that front than in previous years. I think the other lane is guidance and clarity around what in some situations feel like conflicting or confusing laws, guidance, regulations. So school districts ultimately are there to support their students, all of their students, but also want to do so in a way that follows applicable laws. And so it is a challenge, more last year than right now, but it has not gone away. When you have conflicting federal guidance or letters or executive orders or whatever it may be that don't really meet with an interpretation that schools are used to or don't mesh well with guidance at the state level. And so part of our role is to kind of synergize those conversations and make sure we get the information that our school leaders and school board members need to best lead and help lead their school districts and ultimately make sure that the students in our school buildings and our communities each and every day are supported, nurtured, and are set up for a successful life after school in college, career, military, whatever it may be, civic life, etc.
He is Brian Fessler, Chief Advocacy Officer for the New York State School Boards Association. I'm David Gustina. You've been listening to the Capital Connection. Brian, thanks so much for taking the time to join us this week. Appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Really enjoyed it.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.